Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 147, recorded on December 22nd, 2021. Goodbye, 2021. It's been a log4j kind of year. Good evening, Jonathan and Ryan. How's it going?
It's going okay. And I just want to let everybody know that we went through like three or four revisions of that title, just like that for Jay.
Indeed we did. Indeed we did. Yes. Unfortunately, Peter was not able to join us, but he did send his predictions and his look back information. So we'll talk about that. But hopefully he'll join us back in the new year. For those of you who are tuning into us during the holiday season, this is our last show for 2021. We will be back recording on the second week of January. So your first show back will be sometime that third week of January. And we'll be back on a regular scheduled, but we're taking vacation because it's Christmas and we're tired. It's been a long year. So there you go. We'll follow up from last week. Log4j, or Log for Jackass, as I like to call it, came back with a vengeance. Again, it's the gift that keeps on giving this Christmas holiday. With the new vulnerability that was apparently not fixed in 2.16. So if you just had all that time to, you know, remove the JNDI call and then you found out that didn't work and you had to upgrade to 2.16 and you did that work and now that doesn't work for you either. You now need to go to 2.17. And by the time this gets recording, it's published, it may even be 2.22 just to celebrate the new year. So just keep that in mind, that keep an eye on this one as it is continuing to be in the wild with lots of new vulnerabilities and new attack vectors. No one would have expected the logging protocol would be your Achilles heel, but here you go. So if you have not upgraded to 2.17, now it's time to get back to patching. Pause the podcast, go patch and come back after you've done that. Hopefully with a nice stiff beverage to finish up the show. So, well, last year, about this time, we made predictions. And those predictions, you know, may or may not have come true. We'll see. Where those predictions are. Here they are. I got them right here in front of me. This is Ryan's first year doing a prediction because he was not here the year before that. So that's nice and all good. I grabbed the wrong ones in the show notes, so pardon me. So first up, Jonathan, you predicted that Bracket and other quantum technology will become mainstream and start breaking TLS. How'd that go for you?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for the three-letter agencies, but publicly, no.
Yeah.
that didn't work out too well.
Yeah, you were kind of going that direction, I think, at the end of last year, because there was a lot of talk about, quantum forward encryption technologies that couldn't be broken by quantum technology, and that was kind of becoming a big topic. But then it fizzled out very quickly in 2021.
Yeah, I think the reality is that we're probably many years away from real implementations of breaking even current encryption standards. So yeah. But having said that, there are more classes available now for teaching people how to program quantum computers, because I mean I think you really have to build up a critical mass of people so that when the technology is around, there are people who can actually program it. So
yeah, it's very, very true.
I'll take half a point.
Okay. If we were scoring this, I would say no. Peter said that the biggest blocker to cloud adoption will be costs, with individuals spending too much and debt of poor cloud migrations impacting them. And while I think this is true, I think this was true last year as well, for some companies, it's not been a big blocker to people actually adopting the cloud. So I think he misses this one completely. I think cost is becoming a bigger consideration. It's definitely much more in the topic of conversation, but it's definitely not the blocker that I think Peter envisioned with this prediction last year.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah, especially judging by like the bumps in income announced at their earnings. Yeah, doesn't seem that it's blocking much adoption.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it may be a kind of an impedance to retention. And when you start getting those big bills and you realize quite how risky it is to have give somebody a credit card and let anyone spend what they like. So more cost controls in place would be good.
Yeah. I mean, cost controls are always a plus in the cloud, but we like to see more and more of those things come into play as we go along. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to mention the insurance thing, actually. In a way, you kind of almost want insurance for not just data loss, but also for, an unexpected cloud bill, because you want to be able to serve your customers. You don't want to put a cap on your cloud spend if you're serving legitimate customers, but at the same time, if something bad happens and you end up with a $20,000 bill you didn't expect, that could just destroy some small businesses. So in a way, you kind of need like an insurance policy against mistakes.
Well, I had verticalization of the cloud, which has been an ongoing theme of just mocking me, just like we mocked Jonathan for Slack being bought out years ago. but I was pretty accurate on this one. With, you know, as early as February 24th, Microsoft announcing new industry clouds for Launchpad for financial services, manufacturing, and nonprofits. This continued through all the cloud providers as I expected it would. And I would definitely say I won the year on this one. Although Ryan's also was quite exact. we'll get to his in a second. But I do feel pretty good about this prediction, and it worked out just like I expected it would, which was perfect.
Yeah, you can see all the cloud providers are going pretty much in this direction.
It makes a lot of sense, right? It's the specialization is going to allow individual industries to pick it up at a much faster pace than they would if they were having to build everything out. So the verticalization is a huge enabler.
Yeah. I mean, it's in any traditional... I mean, I sort of just follow what SaaS companies do, right? You start with a general product, and then you start specializing the product into verticals. And, you know, it just made sense that we were at this point where to compete effectively against each other, they're going to have to start verticalizing and offering higher value services. And so it just made sense last year for me. I think we were seeing maybe some signs that was going to come anyways, but I took it. I'll take it. All right, Ryan, you had to work from home will be a permanent trend, further breaking traditional security. And I definitely give you the work from home will be a permanent trend. Breaking traditional security.
So, I mean, you did hear major announcements from lots of companies, Google, you know, doubling down on BeyondCorp. And then even, you know, the White House sort of, you know, issuing that the civilian agencies should adopt the zero trust model where you're not like logging in from a protected high walled network. And so, I don't know, like there's been a lot of moves towards this direction. It's still, you know, I think majority of companies are still logging in through VPNs into their protected networks and operating from there. But there was a big, big push this year. I was impressed to see it.
Yeah, it is. You know, work from home seems to be, it's going to be a new thing, especially with Omicron now becoming a big deal once again. And we're talking about lockdowns potentially again in the future and, you know, economy shutting down in all kinds of awful ways. So, you know, work from home is going to be here for a while. I just think is the reality. And, you know, if you have not yet got vaccinated, please go ahead and get that done. I know you may not believe in it, but, you know, we all want to end this just as much as you do. And so please just vaccinate. Finish it. Fix this problem for us. Well, let's move on to our favorite announcements of 2021, which I know we all have, you know, gone through the back catalog of all 2021 trying to find things that we thought were interesting for the year. And I'll start out with one thing that came out, reInvent. So a lot more other ones are further back in the window here. But Amazon Redshift Serverless for running analytics at any scale without having to manage your data warehouse infrastructure. Again, I've been talking about, I felt Amazon was going to try to come out with something to really compete with Snowflake. Which if we had a sound effect for, we could totally drop right there. You know, every time I mention the word Snowflake. You know, I think, again, we're seeing that continual evolution of that. And I continue to think that this is where we're seeing the Redshift stuff go. And I continue to think that we're going to see bigger announcements in this space throughout the year now that serverless is kind of in play. So this is by far my favorite AWS announcement because it just kind of proved what I was saying all year long, which is that I think there's going to be a Redshift thing for Snowflake. And so I'm super happy about that. How about you, Jonathan? What were your favorite announcements from any of the vendors?
So I think my first favorite announcement is OpenSearch, which was announced originally back in April, and then version 1 was released later in the year, I think July, August time. It's now available as a managed service from the formerly known as Elasticsearch Service from AWS, which was really quite a rapid time to market for a new product. I think that may be the fastest sort of from announcement to GA I've ever seen from any provider. It's got a really good community around it now. There are weekly meetings discussing, you know, triaging issues, talking about the roadmap. There's office hours if anyone wants to get involved. There's almost 300 open issues on Git if anyone wants to roll up their sleeves and start helping out with that. And Oracle also announced yesterday that they're offering it as a service to their customer.
Wow.
Didn't we talk about it last week? I talked about it last week.
Yeah, but I wasn't paying attention. Okay. I don't know. That's usually what happens when someone says, "Didn't we already do this?"
Yeah, when I mentioned the Oracle section of the show, you guys all tuned out. Yeah, no, I think we talked. I think we did talk about Oracle and OpenSearch and how it was sort of. I think it was maybe a lightning round topic.
Maybe, you know, it was yesterday when I wrote when the prediction. Read it.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, nice. I mean, the thing about OpenSearch for me is really more of, you know, how bad Elastic has just messed this up. You know, being in the driver's seat, they got angry at AWS for taking their service and turning it into a thing, which was perfectly in their rights for the licensing term, regardless of what you personally feel about it. And what the spirit of open source is. I know there's a lot of people on both sides of that debate. But, you know, even like you're just talking about the community and like how big the community around OpenSearch has gotten all of a sudden, you know, the regular office hours, the calls, the issues, people all working together on it. Like there's a definite a community surge around OpenSearch that I don't think I felt in the Elastic community, at least at the same level. And again, I'm not really involved in either community, so it's really just on the surface I see it. But I see a lot more chatter about OpenSearch on Twitter. I see a lot more chatter about OpenSearch on Reddit than I was about Elasticsearch, which I think is interesting.
There's an awful lot of frustrated people who've tried to open issues with, you know, with quotes, open source Elasticsearch and have gotten nowhere in getting those things merged into the main branches. I mean, I think it was open source for the purposes of free labor and marketing more than anything.
And, you know, the, you know, features that should be basic and part of the base package or they rolled into XPAC and their enterprise offering. And so like it's, I think they were really abusive to the open source community and took it for granted. And, you know, like, so while I agree with their points on like Amazon sort of using their names and that kind of thing, like they had already sort of made that bed by abandoning a very, you know, a very healthy community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how it pans out for them over the next few years. I mean, it hasn't hurt their stock price tremendously yet that I've seen, but, you know, over time it might, and especially if OpenSearch, you know, continues to be a big thing.
Yeah, it's becoming more of a problem though. I mean, I've actually in the day job started to see issues where people are relying on the community Elasticsearch SDK, for example, and they've, if you pull the latest version, it breaks compatibility with non sort of versions less than like 7.13 or something, which is a real pain because they're just really forcing people into adopting this newly licensed version.
It'd be one thing if it was like a compatibility thing, like they had a new feature and it didn't work with this thing. But no, it's literally they inject a string to see if it's an Elasticsearch offering and then just break it, like not because of a feature or function set. It's just so that it doesn't work on OpenSearch.
Yeah, that's not really in the spirit of all the people who've put their time into working on these projects. I mean, I understand that they want to make breaking changes eventually, and their features will diverge, and that's all well and good. But you know, I've opened tickets with Elastic about features which have been sort of not exactly finalized, let's say, for years, exporting objects from you know, command dashboards and things like that. But now all of a sudden, formats are changing, schemas are changing, the API is changing, and it almost seems like a deliberate attempt to diverge from what's left in the OpenSearch community to make the tooling harder for people. And I don't wish bad things on people, but I really hope that they fail. Really, I mean, they're not doing the right thing for the community. I won't say I hope they fail. I hope OpenSearch succeeds.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I don't want that kind of behavior rewarded would be, you know.
Like, yeah. That's a nice exactly. Point.
Yeah. I mean, I want the people who have jobs there to still have jobs and still be able to provide their family, but the corporate entity itself, go through.
Are we taking turns to do these or are we going to run through them all?
Yeah. Ryan's got the next one here.
Okay.
All right. Let's see which one. I think, you know, I'll go with, AWS announcing the Cloud Control API. I think that that's a very interesting sort of announcement from their perspective as a leader in the market. So if for those unfamiliar, it's there's like 11 billion AWS services and there's 11 billion other third-party providers with their own APIs. And, you know, there's the other cloud providers. And this is a way to sort of have a generic API or generic CRUD actions that would work across all of those things. And, you know, Amazon put together, you know, the announcement with a whole bunch of launch partners. They had a, you know, backing support. So they had Terraform support day one, they had Pulumi support day one. And, you know, this enabled very simplistic sort of provider configuration in those ecosystems where you can very, very easily, you know, provision, you know, infrastructure on AWS and maybe a, you know, logging service on that SAS provided and have it all interact together very simply. So it's, I like that. The neat, I'm curious to see where it's going to go in the future. It's, you know, it's limited right now to the basics in these services, but I like the model and I like to see where this would go.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
Yeah, I think it's a good one too. All right. Well, my next one was GKE Autopilot. I really liked this particular one because it solves one of the big complaints I have about Kubernetes in general, which is, you know, I want to manage containers. I don't want to manage nodes and node scaling and dealing with all that stuff. And so, you know, we got things like Fargate from AWS to solve this problem, but Autopilot's a great way to solve this with GKE. And so it's still, you know, infrastructure to run, but it's being managed by them in Autopilot mode, which, you know, is aptly named. Well, good job on that. And so overall, I really like this. I think it comes with a great SLA. I think it comes with, you know, good services that you can leverage, and it's enabled, you know, pretty quickly in your account. And so overall, I think this is a really great move by Google to really continue to strengthen their dominance in what I consider to be the container space, which is where they're dominant.
And this being their flagship product in that space, yeah. What's funny is it wasn't until this announcement that I really kind of learned that it wasn't more automated than it was. Like, I guess it's been too long since I played around with it, so I don't remember setting up like the initial cluster. And of course, you know, back then you didn't pay per cluster like you do now. So, like, I guess there is a difference. Kind of funny.
Yeah, it's you know, there's been Amazon announcements sometimes where they come out with something and you're like, but did it already do that? And you know, if you're not using the service, sometimes you miss those, you know, little bits of nuance that were like, oh, well, it sort of did it, but you had to do a lot of work. And now they made it easy for you. But yeah, that's kind of, that happens quite often with these cloud providers. You got to kind of watch that as we talk about stuff here on the show and how do we think about the show and, you know, do we get more into depth on certain topics to try to flesh that stuff out? You know, we kind of debate that often here.
It's a difficult balance.
It is. Jonathan, how about your second?
My second one's kind of more a change in business practices from Google rather than a specific service. I was super happy to see that they were going to reduce their commission on partner products to the marketplace from 20% down to 3%. 20% is a huge stake in somebody else's business. For small companies, for example, it must be very difficult to sort of, the margins are not going to be that great. So what the hell am I going to say? It's nice to see them not taking such a cut. There's no need to. The system's built. It's all automated. It doesn't cost them to deliver those things. I get that they want to take a cut. 20% is too high. I think it's still too high in the Android marketplace too. I think this is a good, it's a change in the right direction, and I hope Amazon follows suit, as you already did. And I think I hope that the tax on sort of adopting technology, which is really what this has become, continues to trend down.
Yeah. I mean, even expanding to like the Android Play Store and the Apple Store, right? It's one thing to charge for the app as a consumer. I get that. But then to basically take a huge cut of that before it makes it to the people developing the apps, right? Like it's a weird sort of model. And like, you want a little bit to maintain things, keep the, you know, order, bring order to chaos. But when you're charging, you know, doing like 40% markups and stuff like that, it's basically a profit center. Like, why would you do that for work that you're not really doing? You're just providing the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's more or less a fixed cost for them. I mean, they build the marketplace, they have storage costs, they have data transfer charges. In the case of Android, or probably Apple Store, they have people and they have processes going into checking those things to make sure they're not doing, you know, the things they're not supposed to do. But yeah, that doesn't mean they should get a 20% cut or more on things like Netflix subscriptions or any kind of payment through an app. And that's where we're at right now. It's kind of where Visa and MasterCard ended up getting 3 or 4% cut on every transaction you make with a credit card. It's just, it's got to go away.
Yeah.
You know, Bitcoin isn't the solution, but that's got to go away.
Yeah. The biggest impact to me was my audiobook subscription, right? It was like you couldn't, through the app, you couldn't actually get a new book because it was too expensive and they didn't want to pay the cut to Amazon for it, because it's every dollar that's transacted through there is the cut. So it's not just downloading the app, it's everything else. And so it was, you know, they contrived this crazy, you know, credit system in order to sort of work around that. So now there's no monetary value, and you know, screw you, Apple. But
yeah, I remember when they first did that to the Kindle store. It was kind of brutal because you go in the Kindle app, you're like, oh, I want to find our book, and then you know, if you have the Kindle Unlimited Library, I think is what it's called, which is for people who self-publish on Kindle, they can offer their books there. You can download those for free, and you can do that right there in the app. But as soon as you want to buy a book, it you know dumps you off to this terrible web interface that's super clunky, and you're like, why am I doing this versus just using the app? And it's such a negative user experience that you know I think Apple should be ashamed of that, but they've yet to fix that problem. So it's been years now of them being, I mean, you know, but it's weird to me that that isn't allowed because it competes with you know Apple Books, which no one uses. But then, you know, you can still buy, you know, you can still buy goods through the Amazon store. That's okay. Like, what's the difference between buying something through the Amazon store? It's a physical good versus an ebook. Why is that a different rule set? It just doesn't make any sense.
Don't get it.
All right, Ryan, how about your second pick for 2021?
I went with a theme and then picked an announcement that met the theme. You know, I'm a big advocate for security in the cloud to just be easy. I think that, you know, that I think security should be everyone's job, but I also feel that that job should be very easy since it's not going to be your only job or your primary job. And so my favorite announcement was Google announcing DLP being automatic, and rolling out at least in preview for BigQuery, where that it's automatically enabled. You get all the same reporting as enabling or using the DLP service that you would, and then, you know, they have plans to roll that out to other Google services as they go. So, you know, kudos on Google for you know, making fat fingering something where you end up, you know, injecting a whole bunch of PII, or maybe it's customers in putting that data in because they don't know where it's going, and just making that just seamlessly go away.
Yeah, I also looked at that one, and I did consider that one on my list as well. I thought that was good. You know, anything that's automatic that just makes security transparent and but you more secure, I think is a great win. And I wish there was more of those type of services from AWS and from Azure as well. Well, you know, I tried to spread my announcements from my list out between the three vendors just to make it fun. But yeah, there was no rule I had to do that. I could have picked all AWS. I could have picked all GCP. And I had plenty of those, but I struggled to find a good Azure item. And while they had secure enclaves, it was sort of like, yeah, but their invitation is kind of crappy and all that. And, you know, the one that I've settled on was the new look for the Azure icon, because it's a thing that none of us wanted in 2021. And I feel that it really speaks to the overall feeling I had about Azure, was that everything they really announced in 2021 was stuff that no one really wanted, and it was just all underwhelming. And so just like this logo, the Azure pick is underwhelming.
Nice.
Well, my last one is, I also didn't pick an Azure one because there was really kind of slim pickings. It was either going to be the impact of you know, the Cosmos DB exploit.
We're looking for good announcements in 2021, not bad.
You can't say something.
Exactly. That's about the most impactful thing they did this year is screw that up royally. No, my last one was actually Cloudflare pushing Amazon to lower their, or sort of increase their free tier for data egress by announcing their R2 service to compete directly with S3. It's great to see more players in the market. They have a really great CDN. They're offering compute at the edge. It's clearly going to drive costs down, which is going to be good for everybody.
And not everyone who's going to compete with Amazon, Google, and Azure can build out, you know, a portfolio of cloud services. So you're going to have to pick your specialty and sort of compete in that space. And so I'm happy to see, you know, Cloudflare's, you know, small, you know, entity, but, you know, seeing that competition directly in the market.
But, you know, I like this positioning much better than like Wasabi, right? Who came out saying, we're just going to have a way cheaper version of S3. And that's where we're going to start. And now you're trying to build a market out of nothing, where at least at Cloudflare, you have a really quality quality CDN solution that's super effective and people really like it and they love what you're doing. And now you're saying, okay, we're now going to step into this other thing that's sort of adjacent to it. It has a cost savings to you. And so they're able to build on an audience they already have, which I think gives them a much better leg up on being able to actually compete with Amazon versus somebody like Wasabi, who I felt like, you know, people still don't know who they are. Or even Backblaze B2, I think, is also a similar technology where, you know, some people know about it, especially if you have like a Synology or something like that. But most people don't really know that it exists. And they're great solutions to S3 alternatives, but you know, you got to know about it to know that it exists. And so now you're paying the marketing cost to teach people about your product, which is
and it's hard. You know, their primary advantage is the price, you know, like the, you know, the feature comparison at the API level, you know, is going to tail behind Amazon. It almost always does. And they're not really innovating in that space, and they're, you know, they're able to capitalize on that. So, and so it's, yeah, if there's an, you know, if there was a new way, if they were doing, you know, new and interesting things for storage tiers and stuff before, like innovating in the space before other cloud providers, maybe, but that hasn't been the case so far.
I think about the way this improves the general customer experience for Cloudflare customers, though, because now you can store your documents, you know, much closer to their CDN. You're going to reduce latency for fetching the source objects. It's just going to be a growth opportunity for them. First, it'll be storage, then it'll be something else.
Yeah, I mean, if you really think about the kind of the pivot that we've had happening in web technology, it's really been to static websites because they scale and they're super fast. And so you've got a bunch of frameworks like Gatsby and others that give you the ability to do a static website. Well, really the next part of that is giving you a serverless technology for the few things that you do need to be dynamic, like submitting forms or handling basic user flow on a website that's static. That's the next logical place where they would go, in my opinion, is really a serverless play, which I know they have some serverless things already. But I would suspect to see that continue to be an area where they invest next, because if you're really being a modern Web 2.0 application that's, you know, stateless and all these things, like the need for servers, which is how Amazon started, is really not there. And if you say, look, we're not going to support those legacy paradigms, we're only going to support the newer ones, that's a great way to break into this market.
It's continuing the abstraction, right? So it's, you know, it's fulfilling the promise of not really caring about the server labor. And then, you know, as a consumer, not having to maintain it and care and feed it, which is great. You know, it's going to run on a server somewhere, but that's part of the product. There's teams dedicated to just doing that. I don't have to consider it as part of my, you know, overall roadmap.
All right, Ryan, what's your final favorite announcement?
I did a very similar thing trying to pick out one from Azure and just struck out. And so I went in true form to the easy option and to the comfort place. And I picked ECS Anywhere from Amazon.
Not an Oracle announcement.
Huh?
I thought you were going to go for an Oracle announcement of some kind.
Yeah. if only the RSS feed wasn't broken, maybe I would have learned more. But
no, it's fixed.
I know it's fixed now. But there was, most of the year.
Yeah, months of coverage did not cover Oracle because of their failing to properly run an RSS feed, which means they can run your cloud workload really well, sure. You know, so now that ECS Anywhere has been out for a little while, have you used it? That's the big question.
So I have done experiments. I have not actually successfully rolled out any real workloads on it. And so that's, you know, these things take time. And it's, you know, I have a lot of apprehension of, you know, going back to procuring, you know, infrastructure in a data center, just because it's typically not an API call. And, you know, ECS doesn't fix all the things that Amazon does. It just enables sort of a launch pad or an easy button. So, yeah, I mean, it is sort of one of those things that is a little bit tricky that way. And so, but I mean, what I really like about this is just having an option of, you know, running containerized workloads in your data center that's not Kubernetes based. I feel like Kubernetes is a big overhead and solves a lot of problems that you typically don't need to solve for your generic run-of-the-mill web serving container workloads. And so the fact that you, in order to get the basics running there, you will have to establish a team to build and maintain a lot of infrastructure, whereas ECS Anywhere is still using and leveraging the managed service aspects of ECS. So scheduling, task placement, a lot of the metadata gathering, all that's still happening outside. And so your workload is running in your data center, so you can have data sovereignty, but you are not running, you know, the more complex options.
I'm excited to get my hands on it and play with it a little bit more. I still think it needs it needs some more thought around the networking piece, though, because I want to be able to hook my on-prem containers to load balancers running in AWS more easily. I have a transparent network tunnel of some kind so I can access VPC resources without having to provision my own VPN. I think there's huge opportunity to make that a much more seamless sort of experience, because you know the idea is that you can move these containers back and forth between different locations. All those things should still be accessible from everywhere.
I think Amazon's taken the position where they're not going to solve that in the ECS product. They're going to solve that at the VP, the networking products. And so I think that the Cloud WAN announcement at reInvent is specifically geared towards this, right? Because that's going to enable that reachability in a much easier way.
Yeah, I agree. Well, let's move on to, we looked at, what you predicted for 21, and we did pretty well. And then we talked about our favorites, but let's look, get the crystal ball out. Let's see. What do you guys think is coming forward to us in 2022? And Ryan, I put you.
Oh, you jerk. He put me up first because he knows I'm not prepared. Yeah, my choices right now are, it's a comet that's going to crash into, not the Mexican Peninsula this time, but maybe, somewhere in Siberia and take us all out. Send us into decades of nuclear winter, or I'll go more still sort of dystopian future because I just can't get my head out of it, but a little bit more positive, which is Google will build the first data center region at sea in 2022.
Interesting. Asia is definitely ahead of the game on that because they have that underwater data center thing they built, but it's not a region. So I
forgot about the underwater thing. Yeah. No, I think this is going to be a big, I'm just waiting for someone to capitalize on the floating plastic island and just be and monetize it. And so add some stability, some, wind turbines, start running some servers.
Yeah. Wave power, wind turbines. You got free cooling in a way if you put the thing in the right place. Mm-hmm. Now we've got satellite connectivity to it. I mean, you could have floating data centers all over the place. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting idea. Also, pirates may be a slight concern.
But apparently, if you just play Britney Spears, the pirates don't attack you. I read that on the news once.
Very nice. Jonathan, how about your 2022 prediction? Is Slack going to get bought this year?
I've given up on that. And you watch. Something's going to happen. I was going to say that I think we're going to run out of Greek letters for COVID variants, and we're going to have to break out into the Cyrillic alphabet, which I don't know how to pronounce. Yeah. So
that's right. No one can pronounce Omicron or whatever it is either. So we're good.
All right. I don't hear Omicron. I think it's like a transformer. Omicron Prime.
I say it different every time.
But as far as tech predictions go, I was kind of disappointed there were no database related announcements at reInvent this year. I still don't have my serverless graph database. Maybe it's because there's something else in the works. So I'm going to predict that Amazon will release a new database service this year, next year, whatever, 2022.
Maybe their answer to Cloud Spanner, perhaps.
You know what? There's so many good things about so many different types of database management systems. Relational is so useful for a lot of things. Document-based databases are so useful for a lot of things, and graph databases are so useful. I mean, wouldn't it be awesome to have something that kind of like ruled them all in a way? Not that I think that's going to be. I'm not going to narrow myself down to something that solves every problem everywhere. But I think there's room for something which provides a good experience for developers. And also has some of the features of these other things.
I'd worry that since data performance is such a vital part of application performance that you'd end up with a jack of all trades as a I can't even remember the full colloquialism. Awesome, master of none is how it ends, right? You can do a bit of everything, and that I'd worry about that because I think that's would have huge impact to the data layer. And so, I've kind of gone the other way, which I'm glad there's still things like being developed and coming out, like Graph and that kind of thing, so that we can continue to specialize. So it's interesting to see you go the other way.
I mean, people can still use those other technologies. I mean,
You might still get serverless Neptune. That may still happen. But you're saying you think a whole new database thing is out there.
I'd like to see that.
I think so. And
that's interesting.
There's probably either Neptune doesn't have enough customers because nobody knows what the hell it is.
That's my problem with GraphQL databases. I'm like, I don't really know what to do with it. Like, what is it exactly? I'm still working it out.
Yeah, either they don't have enough customers to make it worth investing in serverless, or the customers they do have don't care about the cost, or don't care about being serverless, or there's a technology problem which means that they can't take what they already have for Neptune and turn it into something that's serverless because it's slow to start, requires tons of memory. There's lots of reasons why to be performant it would need to be on all the time.
I mean, you price it appropriately, right? Like, it just because it's serverless from a customer perspective doesn't mean it's actually serverless. So like it's, that kind of thing. Yeah. But because there's still a lot of, even if you're paying, a similar price, if it's patched and managed and completely kind of owned, there's still advantage and value outside of that.
Agreed.
Hey everyone, Jonathan here. I just wanted to take a minute to thank the cloud consulting gurus at Foghorn for helping make the CloudPod possible. These folks truly get it. Cloud consulting experts since 2008, they are premier tier partners with AWS, Google Cloud Platform Silver, and Microsoft Azure partners. From multi-cloud to containers to moving full production workloads to the cloud under the tightest compliance, Foghorn's team of full-stack cloud engineers have been there, done that, gotten the t-shirt, and are ready to share their experience with you. If you're in the market for some talent to supplement your team, visit www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. Foghorn, the promise of cloud delivered.
Well, my prediction, I think I talked about it a couple times on the show that there's really no good way to understand how to break your app up between the edge and the non-edge, auto availability zone or whatever. And I've sort of said it a couple times on the show where I'm like, someone really needs to solve this problem of, how do I design an app that dynamically takes advantage of these things. And so I think this year we'll see something, either a new SDK or programming language or thingy that makes it easier to design and build applications that stretch from edge to servers. And so I it's partially a wish list item for me that I really want that. But I also think it makes sense. It's the next evolution of what was going to happen in that space. Cause I think designing and architecting those apps today is hard.
How do you know if it goes to the edge? Well, when it stops performing in your data center and you have to do something.
Yeah, exactly. But, and there's times where the job, you want it to be on the edge for this thing, but if it's this other type of parameter, I want it to be on-prem. And, there's so much complexity to that design decision. And so I think, just like we made getting to a CDN much easier. Remember when they first came out, you had to, upload all your objects to Akamai, and then you had to reconfigure your web application to point to all the images to an Akamai URL and all that. Then they figured out, if we put the thing in front of it and then we just make this an origin lookup, it makes it so much easier, right? Like I feel like something like that's going to happen in this space because it has to, right? Because otherwise it's just so complicated. And so that's what I'm hoping for. And so that's where I'm going.
I remember talking about that exact same thing earlier in the year and suggesting that something like that should be built that figures all these things out for you. I have to go back and find that.
We have talked about it on the show a couple times, but I'm going to take it as a prediction because I want to. It's either that or Azure's finally going to figure out security, but I thought that was a longer shot.
Things to throw out to the universe, just hopefully. Yeah.
Well, Peter's not here, and we'll harass him when he's back about what his three favorite things are. He can't get off the hook that easily. We're gonna hold him personally responsible to give us three in his first episode back. But he did give us a prediction, and he said that zero companies in the Fortune 500 will announce an all-in agreement with a single cloud vendor strategy in 2022.
Pretty solid pick.
He can. We're going to make him go through the announcements for the year to make sure that he always picks these very difficult to measure things.
Oh yeah, I follow the press releases where Amazon and these guys announce those things. So I will keep an eye on them, but he should go through them as well. Like, you need to go prove that you got this right or not.
I mean, it's Fortune 500. Limiting the scale of the companies. I'm okay with this, and I definitely think that he's going to get this one, just because I don't think
I think he's not going to get it, and I'll tell you why. Because all-in announcements are marketing, And so even vendors who are not, you know, companies who are not all in on a single cloud provider will still do an all-in announcement with AWS. That we're all in on AWS as our primary data center. Like that's, you know, no cloud provider is going to let them come up and say, you know, we're a multi-cloud solution and but we're using AWS. Like no one's going to let them do that. So if you're going to continue to do that marketing play, so I think he's going to lose.
I mean, it's the same reason why I think it won't happen. Actually, it's the same marketing. I think that the value of that statement saying I'm going all in a single provider just doesn't have the same impact and can be, it could be sort of, you know, backwards or dated in a sense of like, what do you mean you're going all in a single provider? I think I think the industry is adopting hybrid workloads in a major way. I think that the majority of workloads are very difficult to move as is into a cloud provider in a way that makes sense. And so I think it's going to take a lot longer than people realize to get out of hybrid. So I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see.
Time will tell.
Well, overall, we did have some other things that I thought we'd mentioned about 2021 that I think impacted us here on the show or things that were just kind of cool. So first up was Jedi died.
Woo-hoo! So sad.
Contract was canceled. Pentagon said, we're bailing on this. We're going multi-cloud, which, you know, kind of goes back to the point. I think that's great. The other one, when it happened, I didn't see it as a big deal, but, you know, Pluralsight acquired AcloudGuru this year to really accelerate solving the biggest challenge around growing IT and really closing the cloud skills gap. And at the time, I thought that was a really great outcome for AcloudGuru staff. But with a massive exodus of staff from AcloudGuru, like people like Forrest Brazil going to GCP from AcloudGuru, you know, it seems like it's actually become an interesting sinking ship that people are just running for the hills from, which is interesting because it's now pushing a lot of that skill set into cloud providers and into different parts of the market. And so I think it's going to be an interesting ripple effect over the next year as we continue to see, you know, people like Forrest do things like Google and the evangelism side of this. And I think we're going to look back at the AcloudGuru and say that was a bad acquisition at some point in the future.
It's such a shame. I agree with you completely. It's just that the problem that they're, you know, trying to solve is real, right? Like there is a big challenge and a big gap in skills. And, you know, Pluralsight had a huge market base and so tons of customers in theory, but they would have to develop all their own content. So like the move made perfect sense when they made it, but I think it goes to say that much like a company, you know, an enterprise company adopting cloud computing as part of their ecosystem, you have to change the way you do business, and because these things aren't compatible, you don't maintain, you know, a business in a very stark plaid, you know, or drab, you know, office space with no fun. You know, these cloud computing is, you know, a lot about the culture and the community, and if you kill that culture and community, it's very hard to retain people.
Yeah. Speaking of retaining people, Vertex AI, which was an interesting announcement because it's basically SageMaker but for Google, and it happens to be built by the product manager from AWS who built SageMaker, who then went to Google and built it again, but better and stronger, hopefully, as Vertex AI, as well as, you know, recently we just saw an announcement that one of the DocumentDB developers had moved back to Mongo. So, you know, the exodus that's happening at AWS is now starting to have impact on other clouds and other companies. And those exoduses are tied to, you know, all kinds of things from stock compensation and compensation plans, and AWS is struggling, or Amazon.com, not AWS, but Amazon.com is starting to get a bad reputation that people aren't feeling so great about working for. So I think Vertex AI and the DocumentDB thing, like, this is a sign of people are starting to shift in the cloud world and they're starting to go to other providers and starting to build the things again they already built. And so that's going to be interesting impact on the next year or two as we see that continue down the path.
Yeah, looking forward to MongoDB. That is DynamoDB compatibility. Right.
That'd be great. Amazon finally launched something in ML that I understand. Computer vision for manufactured products. So that was it was an honorable mention for me on my 2021 things. I get this one. I know what a defect looks like, and I know that machine learning can find it. ECS exec, because it was one of my longest standing PFRs that I wanted to be able to get into the Docker executive through ECS, which is great. Super happy about that one as well. And then, you know, other things I thought would never happen: troubleshoot boot and networking issues with EC2 serial console. Never thought that would happen either. So that was kind of nice to see those two come about. And then Fault Injection Simulator, Chaos Engineering coming to mainstream, I think is interesting, as well as FSX for what I'm now calling FSX for X, because now we have OpenZFS. We got NetApp earlier this year. We already had Windows compatibility, and then we also have a couple other things there too. But if that's the future of what FSX is going to be, I'm super excited about where that's going and what else comes into that family over the next year.
No, so. Huge flexibility and you know, more importantly, it's that storage layer that I don't have to deal with, right? So that's Amazon's problem now. It's great.
Yep. Not my issue. You're gonna patch NetApp for me? Thank you. I don't want to do that.
Oh, you're gonna RMI all those drives? Sweet. Yeah.
Yep. Make sure you destroy them. I don't want you to send my data back.
Yeah, words you don't hear very often anymore. Degaussing.
Oh, I still have nightmares about my data center days and degaussing hard drives.
So I remember the thing we used to do, the monitor, you hit the button and it would like demagnetize the screen. It would that was always fun too.
A technical term.
Everyone knew what you're talking about, though.
Yeah. Nobody saw the hands shaking, though.
They did. In their head.
Well, any other comments on 2021 before we head into the new world of 2022?
I'm just going to hope that USC's one has a better year next year because it's been...
It's been a rough month for USC's one.
It's
Yeah, I didn't put the outage this morning into the show notes, but apparently they had a data center AZ power failure that caused, of course, all of the who's of US East 1 poster boys to be down this morning, including Slack not being able to give a thumbs up to a message, which I found hilarious. Yeah, and the thing about that is, you know, that's the one that you should be protected from. A single AZ failure that, you know, you should be recovering from that, in my opinion. And these companies have chosen not to do that. Heroku is probably the worst offender where they've had that defect now for 10 years, it seems like. I mean, every outage of USC's one, Heroku's always impacted because they're single AZ. And they've been single AZ since they were born. And I don't understand that that model. Like, I get there's a cost. I get inter-region data transfer fees are awful. But, you know, at some point, you got to start saying, like, is this product real? And if you're not willing to invest, why are you, you know, is it a real product that we should care about?
Mm. It's pretty hard to offer a service at a fixed cost, though, with multi-AZ because of that data transfer costs.
Yep. So, again, maybe this is where Amazon should step up and figure out their pricing on inter-region. Because, you know, you know that's got to be dark fiber between their data centers.
Yeah, it's some cost. Sure, but...
You know, like, or if it's not, you know, run some dark fiber. They're not supposed to be that far apart from each other. It can't cost you that much to do it.
Yeah.
And get off the public internet for these things.
And it's weird. It's also not a capacity issue because you never hear in architecture reviews, hey, you really need to do this to avoid cross AZ traffic. It's always, you need multiple AZs.
Yeah.
And if you actually model out the costs of changing, making just some small architectural changes to deployments, you can save a bunch of money. by not taking use of cross AZ load balances, for example, and you keep everything sort of in serially through a single AZ until the point where you actually need cross AZ redundancy. Yeah. So I modeled that out for Elasticsearch, and you know, we were going to save $10,000 to $15,000 a month just in cross AZ traffic with minor tweaks.
It's just removing a region. That's all you got to do is just not deploy to, you know, instead of deploying to three, deploy to two. And you can save 20% of your bill. Like that's ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it's penalizing you for the one practice they tell you to do. So it's just, you know, it has its challenges. So hopefully that gets fixed in 22. I wasn't willing to put it on my prediction sheet.
No, there's no hope for TireFire 1. No chance.
No, not TireFire 1. I'm just, you know, inner region transfer fees.
Oh yeah. No, there's
and egress traffic fees. I'd love to see that get fixed. I just have no confidence.
Maybe that's just the optimist to me. I think Amazon's taken a lot of heat over time where I think it will pile up on them. I think that Oracle making a big splash with Zoom, I think it was this year, but that might've been 2020 over the networking and, you know, cost prohibitiveness. Like they're starting to build a case where, I don't know if it's going to happen 2022, but something's got to give.
I don't know that it's impacting them enough. That's the problem, right? Because Zoom is still multi-cloud, like even though they're on Oracle or something, you know, they're still multi-cloud. You know, Corey Quinn's been, you know, yelling at the internet for years now about, you know, NAT transfer fees. You know, and there's people who've been very vocal about this in the community for a long time. You know, even Ben Kehoe and Forrest, and you know, we are very vocal about it as well. They don't seem to care. Yeah. So I just, you know, I just don't know that they're going to fix it ever.
Yeah. Well, true.
I mean, that's where all your margin comes from in your cloud business. Why would you ever change it? Because the margins had to be outrageously high on their networking stuff.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, but I mean, compare that with what it would cost you to have, you know, a 10 gig pipe delivered to a data center. You pay for that. You pay a fixed fee for that every mm-hmm. month, whether or not you send a single packet.
Yeah, but
whereas in the cloud, you get access to that type of connectivity, and you only pay for the bytes you transfer. So I think it's reasonable that there's a significant upcharge on a per gig basis to cover the cost of that massive connectivity that Amazon are paying for all the time.
I mean, if you go to level 3 and you say you want a 10 gig circuit to the internet, you know, you're probably looking at anywhere from $1,500 to $3,000 a month for that circuit. And you know, then you're talking about, okay, well, I have two data centers and I want to run dark fiber between them through an MPLS network, or I want to do that. You're probably looking at about, you know, $5,000 a month for that. You know, so you know, you add those costs together, and you know, maybe I come out to like $40,000, you know, with all the redundancy and all the multi vendors you want to do on that, $40,000 a year. And then look at that cost of my Amazon bill, and I'm like, ooh, that number is pretty big. So I'm not convinced that that's the case. That it's just, you know, I don't think we're getting the advantage that Amazon is on the cost of data going down. I mean, because you know, I remember back in 97, a T1 would cost you, you know, an arm and a leg to get a monthly T1 circuit rent to your business or to your home or wherever you wanted it. And now, you know, years later, you know, you can probably get a T1 for $200 a month. Like, I mean, it's just, you know, but we've not seen that reflection in data transfer cost reductions that we've seen in the rest of the market. You know, despite the fact that there's been huge improvements in fiber optics, there's been huge improvements in last mile connectivity. Like, there's just so much that is improved that the cost has gone down for everyone else but AWS. So either AWS's networking strategy is terrible, it's super expensive what they're doing, or they're just not passing that savings to us. And I think that's the answer. I don't think they're passing the savings.
Yeah. I mean, it could be worse. It could be that no one's using it, right? Because they're not fault tolerant across regions. So it doesn't come up.
I mean, it comes up with enough people that I'm sure that's,
well, even Slack, you know, like, if it, you know, like, I, the, you know, if it was just limited to the thumbs up or icons and stuff like that, like, you can argue that that's fault tolerant. Like, if there's a little degradation,
it's not a super critical feature.
Little degradation, like, why pay for the redundancy on that one? You don't have to be fully transparent to your customers in case of an outage or a failure, but you know, you just have to provide your key function.
But yeah, I mean, between US East 1 complete outage for the region, and then US West 2 had that blip where BGP dropped out for them, and now this data center fire. Yeah, mm-hmm. it's been a rough quarter or month, really, just December.
December's been bad. Yeah. In general, December's been bad. Like, yeah. Omicron, Log4j. No, screw this. Yeah. I am ready for this year to be over. Yeah.
Yep.
I'm going to drink for the rest of the year and hopefully black out for the next 2 weeks.
Well, the good news for the rest of the show is that Log4j has also consumed our cloud vendors' time. So they have not released a lot. So we're going to talk about a couple of different things. Not a lot here. We'll get through this pretty quickly, I think, tonight. So you can get back to your holiday festivities and enjoy your new year. But AWS, first up, they've simplified the setup of Amazon Detective with AWS organizations. This is a guide, you know, a guideline blog post to basically walk you through setting up the Amazon Detective at the organizational level. They talk about how there's a detective administrative account now that can centrally conduct security investigations across all of your accounts, as long as you don't have more than 1,200, because it is limited to 1,200 per behavior graph. And then accounts can also be members of multiple behavior graphs around that limitation. They did also highlight some new things that came out in Detective recently, the new resource-focused views, allowing you to investigate entities and behavior. So if you're curious about an RDS issue, for example, you can focus on just the RDS boxes. New finding overviews to give you expanded details on each finding, as well as providing links to the profiles for each involved entity, and integration with Splunk via the Splunk Trumpet project, which I don't know anything about, but I'm going to read about it later.
Yeah. So, I suspect it's, you know, it's an easy button enablement to tie these two together, because so many security orgs are using Splunk as their SIM. And so the fact that, you know, the Splunk Trumpet project makes me think it's probably an open source connector that has for multiple, you know, parties. Okay, you've already did I buy you enough time to do a little Google search on the back?
Yeah, you bought me enough time. So Trumpet is a tool that leverages CloudFormation to set up all the AWS infrastructure needed to push AWS CloudTrail config and GuardDuty data to Splunk using an HTTP event collector. And once the defense has been deployed, the user only needs the Splunk add-on for AWS and Splunk app for AWS installed on their Splunk environment. Start analyzing your AWS data. Yeah, so the easy button for Splunk enablement. Perfect. you called it. Not even reading.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, these things sort of write themselves in a sense, because this is such a ubiquitous need that everyone has. You have a whole bunch of security analysts that aren't going to be cloud compute specialists, and they have all this data and this product that they don't understand. So getting it to a product that they do understand, right, you know, works out.
Yeah, oh. Amazon calls this undifferentiated heavy lifting.
Actually, they understand it, but they use it.
Oh, yeah.
they misinterpret it quite often. That's what I find. Well, if you were super excited about Amazon Fault Injector Simulator, but then you found out that it didn't support Kubernetes, you might have been kind of disappointed. But Amazon, with this article, is walking you through how to use Litmus Chaos, which I had not heard of until this, which is chaos engineering for Kubernetes. And this walkthrough gets you through setting up and configuring all the chaos integration for Kubernetes. It has a couple pods that you attach to a Kubernetes cluster, gives you a nice slick web interface, which looks pretty nice. And you can set up all of your experiments and tests to do things like kill a pod, kill a node, do all the things that you would expect to have die and horrible deaths in a Kubernetes environment, as well as node CPU hog, which is my favorite one.
Yeah.
So that's a really nice way to go test your chaos theory. I do hope this, this is open source project, Litmus Chaos. So, you know, Amazon, just build this into Fizz. Like, don't make me do this extra step, but, or build it into EKS as a plugin for EKS.
Well, so this is the challenge with Kubernetes in Amazon, which is that it's a managed service. They're managing the Kubernetes app. It's actually really hard to inject these things. Like the pods and the application constructs are customer data, right? Like it's not exactly the same thing. And so like it's a little interesting to see them sort of announce this, because I think it's more of a reaction to everyone saying, why wasn't this in the Fault Injection Simulator? And it's like, well, because that's not really, you know, that's not really our part of the shared security model, our part of the, you know, the responsibility model. This is more like it's a managed application we run. But I think that's most people's misinterpretation of what Kubernetes is.
Yeah, but I think they need to get good at it, though, because they do offer you AWS Marketplace for containers. So you can buy containers through the marketplace now and get them published to your EKS cluster or to your ECS cluster. Mm-hmm. So in theory, this is just a managed application I'm pushing to my container infrastructure that I'd like you to deploy for me. And
that's fair.
So, I mean, like they have the concept. They just need to go the extra mile to orchestrate it.
So, I mean, I guess I'm missing the point. What are we testing exactly? If we're not chaos engineering the application itself, if we're introducing chaos into the managed service, why do I care about that? Why do I need to?
Not introducing chaos into the managed service. That's exactly what this is. This is chaos testing of the app layer, and that's why it's not integrated into fault injection. This is because it doesn't make sense to test application level faults through that managed service.
Yeah, so like the default that they're walking you through on this is setting up an auto-scaling, cluster auto-scaler test. So basically, you're trying to run too many pods, you don't have the right stuff, is your auto-scaling working properly? It's something you need to test. What happens if your pod gets deleted? What happens if a node needs to drain? Does your application fail over gracefully as a node gets drained? What if a CPU, what if a noisy neighbor on a node is causing problems? So you have a test for that to basically validate that all your things you thought you built that work actually work, in just like any other chaos engineering experiment. You're just testing these ideas and concepts that they work. And, there's a way I'm sure they'll add things like latency, and they'll add other things to mess with the service mesh over time and all kinds of fun stuff. But these are failure things that you want to be orchestrating for and be prepared for, but you just need to be able to test it. Say, yes, it actually works the way I think it should work.
I mean, because to make it fit with a fault injector, you'd be simulating failure of the Kubernetes service itself, right? Like half the nodes going away, or, the API not responding. It's not what people need.
Which may, yeah. I mean, you do need that at some level as well. You do need to test those scenarios too. Like, what happens if I lose connection to the control plane that's managed by AWS for Kubernetes? Right. I can see that there is some value there. But it's a combination of both things you need to have. So, again, that's why I would like to see them integrated at some level to really validate the experiment. Next up is container scanning updates for Amazon ECR private registries using the new inspector. Of course, the new inspector. Alexa, stop.
She's mad at you today, man. I don't know what you did to fizz her off.
Alexa, stop.
Every time it's a lecture, too. That's my favorite part. Like,
yeah, it's not just a quick, like, I didn't understand what you said. It was 4 score and 7 years ago. Anyways, Amazon ECR private registry is using the new Amazon Inspector. Allows you to enable registry level configuration for image scanning with enhanced scanning capabilities with ECR or just default scanning images. The new enhanced scanning is a 0.9 or basically 9 cents per image scan for enhanced and a penny for every rescan. While basic scanning is 72 available for no charge and supports all of the common Linux distributions, including Debian, Ubuntu, and Amazon Linux for your container runtimes. So this is great. This is one of the big complaints about Inspector in the past was that it didn't handle containers gracefully or well or at all.
Yeah.
And so now it actually handles it and actually handles it inside your repo, which is a great competitive option to things like Aqua Security and others out there.
Yeah, this is, you know, I'm glad to see Inspector getting some love. And it speaks to the fact that they've completely redesigned this from the ground up. Because even just the concept of doing this with the previous version of Inspector, like none of that fits. So this is, this is cool. I can see how this is going to be a little expensive, but I think that cost is probably already being paid especially if you're already running these services, if you break it out. So it'd be interesting. You know, I have some math to do in my day job to see, you know, if it's competitive pricing wise. The rescan though is going to be very nice because that's
it rescans automatically by default, so you got to be careful that you don't rack up a huge bill if you've got a ton of containers and you don't want that to happen. I see the advantage in doing that. Obviously, if there's more vulnerabilities that are being tested for, then it makes sense to rescan for those new things. But yeah, be aware that it will scan everything automatically.
That is the big difference, right? Because typically with the other solutions, you're scanning at build time at image creation.
But I mean, if you have 10,000 images in your repo, you know, at a penny a piece at a rescan, it's what, $100.
Yeah, I mean,
but how many times? Well, but I mean, how many times are you paying? Are you paying $100 a day?
I assume it's every time they update the CVE database. Is potentially where they'd want to do that.
That's really the where you have to be careful, right? So
Log4j costs us even more money now. That's great. You know what? I kind of wish it wasn't per image. I wish it was per layer, because
if it was per layer, I'd be much happier. That's a very good call.
Because now, you know, now every app that we build is based on the same common layer underneath. I only want to scan that layer once. So I don't want to scan it 10,000 times. And then cascade those reports down. So, you know, if it's no longer a vulnerability in the next layer down, then great. Just don't report on it for that image.
Yeah, as I said, it says right here in the article, whenever Amazon Inspector adds a new CVE to its database, all eligible container images in your configured Amazon ECR repo are automatically rescanned.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, so that could I say it's a minimum at least once a day.
Yeah.
So again, you know, $100 a day for 30 days. Now you're talking a little bit of money.
Yeah.
But I mean, again, but that's a 10,000 images. Like, I don't know how many companies have that many.
Yeah, you'd be surprised.
I'm hoping you're all following good container practices, and this is not as expensive as it sounds.
Yeah. Most registry technologies do deduping at the layer level, and so you can have 10,000 images, but really only a couple hundred layers. And so it's not a huge storage cost for images themselves.
Yeah. And maybe that's a good feature request someone should make is, hey, you know, the Ubuntu base image that I use for all of my containers, I only want to pay for that. Yeah. So maybe that'll come out in the future. We'll keep our fingers crossed. Well, Google has apparently started cracking down on a rule they haven't been cracking down on in the past, which is causing all sorts of headaches for their partners. So, you know, as Jonathan said, that he loved the fact that they're only charging them 3%. But apparently Google is also limiting their business in the fact that they are not allowing them to sell third-party software as part of a Google Cloud deal. So if you were going to a turnkey vendor who wanted to sell you Google Cloud plus, you know, maybe Splunk, our MongoDB licenses on top of that as a turnkey solution. Apparently that's against the terms of service in Cloud Marketplace. And it's been that way in the terms of service since 2018, prohibiting partners from reselling third-party software. Yet for the last few years, it's been unenforced until last quarter when an executive at Google started telling them to crack down on it. And they say this is due to possible regulatory issues for the company. I'm not really sure why it would be a regulatory issue, but apparently Google feels that way. And Google is also putting teeth in it that the sales reps who are involved in those deals will not be compensated their commission if they help a third party sell non-Google software. So at the end of the year, they're now putting hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue at risk, according to this article. And hopefully this gets addressed quickly as companies like SoftChoice and others who specialize in selling third-party software are definitely hurting from this particular change of policy.
Yeah, that's really quite crappy.
you know, Google gives you and takes away all the same.
Yeah, I mean, and also consider that you can't build a service on GCP that competes with any Google service either. So the partners, they can't sell third-party things, and they can't build things on GCP that compete with anything that Google already does.
Wait, is that what it says?
Yeah, that's in the terms and conditions.
Yikes.
Yep. So you can't make your own BigQuery on top of Google, huh?
Yeah, which is, you know, getting harder and harder. The more services they offer, the fewer things you can do that compete with them, so.
Yeah, so then what happens, like, for their partners, like, I know, Confluent. Like, Confluent's a partner. They sell Kafka as a managed service. And then Google decides to build a Kafka service to compete with MSK. Now, all of a sudden, is Confluent screwed as a partner? Like, that's a weird wrinkle, too. And maybe that's Google's way of saying, we're never going to compete with you because we would screw you over and you're making us money.
Well, and you should trust that all the way to the bank because Google will never change their mind on that decision.
They never kill any browsers. Ever. RIP, Google Reader. For life. Gartner, of course, released their cloud database managed systems Magic Quadrant. And Google, of course, wanted to highlight the fact that they are, for the second year, a leader in the Magic Quadrant. Of course, they're a leader behind Oracle, Microsoft, and AWS, which is always a fun wrinkle to these things. But, you know, hey, you're a leader in the quadrant, so, you know, more power to you. And many companies' procurement processes, who's number one and two in the quadrant? And if that's your one or two, that's the better you go with. You know, through the article here, they had all kinds of interesting little insights, of course, the strengths and weaknesses, or cautions, as they call them, in the Gartner parlance. You know, one of the weird ones, AWS, they said one of their cautions was their AWS-centric focus. AWS is the largest cloud vendor, however, it's behind some of the CSPs and virtually all ISVs in offering its service on multiple cloud platforms. Huh, so weird. Can't imagine a cloud provider. I mean, they're not I don't see in the Google cautions that they're, you know, complaining that Cloud Spanner doesn't cross multiple clouds, but no, AWS is going to get penalized for that despite RDS and some of the other things they offer to you on premise. Just because they don't offer them in Google or Azure doesn't mean they don't care. Maybe they don't. I don't know. A couple other interesting things, of course, you know, they always give you the classic hybrid experience is lacking at GCP, which is really unfortunate because GCP is missing lots of services, as I've learned in my last few months now using GCP. So the fact they don't really support hybrid well other than Anthos can be problematic. And their user experience continues to change. They said it was bad. You know, Microsoft got inconsistent ecosystem maturity with all their new cloud database products, including Purview, Synapse, and industry data models, which were things we could have mentioned as well, by the way, for things that Azure did this year that were interesting. But no one understands what Purview or Synapse are other than makes my synapses die in my brain. So that's where you are. And then overall, their pricing is problematic, data architecture challenges in the Microsoft portfolio, et cetera. And then, of course, Oracle cautions the premium price perception. And then they're apparently saying that cloud transition focus for Oracle is causing them to be slow to offer a true DB platform as a service managed service. And this is causing ISP companies to use other solutions for databases than Oracle's, which they didn't mention the fact that everyone hates Oracle as one of the cautions. It was the one I would have gone with as number one.
Brand name, reputation. Like, you could have softened the wording and still put it in there, you know, like there's like.
Yeah. Anything of interest that you guys have about this in the Magic Quadrant? I mean, Magic Quadrant.
Yeah, other than, as usual, I disagree issues. With both the strengths and the cautions on all these things. Like, it continues to be a valuable research point, which bothers me because I feel dirty. But it is a useful bit of information, the way they describe these things. It is nice to know. But it's also sort of, as users of all these platforms, like, I feel like they've missed on so many points, you know. Best fit, you know, like just it's completely devoid of context and doesn't make any sense.
It's one of many perspectives. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm. And it's not my perspective, so that's
yes, wrong. Indeed.
I mean, it's you know, they're useful if they agree with you and you want to use them as justification. Hey, look, you know, Gartner Magic Quadrant agrees with what I'm trying to sell to my leadership or something. Fantastic. Otherwise, pick a different report that agrees with you. It's
All right, let's move on to Azure. They announced NFS version 4.1 support, which, I mean,
woo!
This is just a classic example of Azure's year. Yeah. Like, yay.
What?
You know, you know, super, super glad you gave us NFS version 4.1, which is only really super important production features that supports locking for distributed systems. So if you're trying to run a distributed system on top of NFS and you haven't used another protocol that's more like Lustre for this purpose, you know, you can now use NFS with locking support built in. There are some other nice enhancements, though, from a performance perspective. You now get a minimum of 3,000 IOPS up from the previous 400 IOPS, which is a pretty big increase. Yeah. And you can increase your minimum burst of IOPS up to 10,000 and with paid options all the way up to 100,000. And then the other cool thing they did is now 100% of your provision throughput will now be allocated to you for both reads and writes. So if you said you wanted 100 gigabits per second, you'll get that for both reads and writes versus the previous 40-60 split they used to do between writes and reads. So that, overall, storage infrastructure at Azure is potentially getting much better. There's been lots of interesting announcements on the storage throughput side. And that's how they get SQL Server to scale. So I understand why they need it. I understand where they're going with it. But so that's Azure NFS version 4.1 support in Azure Files.
It also supports multipathing for the first time. I mean, to be fair, NFS 4.1 is now 12 years old. But, it does support multipathing, which I can see as being a fairly useful feature for a cloud provider trying to, a trunking, basically, of NFS connections over multiple physical links.
Yeah.
Yeah, except for, multipathing is not a problem I worry about in the cloud.
It shouldn't be. But this is Azure.
Yeah.
The lift and shift of cloud providers.
What is even the most current version of NFS? I don't even think I know. Is it?
No, I stopped caring about that when I started using the cloud full time.
Yeah, exactly. I moved to object storage, and NFS died to me. And I no longer cared. I don't even know what version of NFS EFS supports. Other than I do know they support V3 because they support authentication, but that's all I know. Well, Larry Ellison found a way to really get under Andy's skin this week. Everyone knows that Larry and Andy don't get along very well. Include they have a mutual hatred for each other. Just call it what it is. However, this time Larry hit Amazon where it hurts potentially in the pocketbook by reaching an agreement to buy Cerner Corp for $28 billion, which takes the potentially important high-profile customers away from AWS. Cerner is in the electric health record space, number two provider after Epic, an area that all cloud providers are eager to grow in. And it should be assumed that all of their current AWS footprint will migrate to Oracle Cloud. And who knows, maybe Oracle will even go over more aggressively after healthcare customers with Cerner. This is the only vendor that actually made sense for Oracle to buy because they do use Oracle database at the back end for Cerner, unlike Epic, which is built on top of Inner Systems Cache. So overall, this is a big buy for Larry in general for just his normal business of trying to be dominant in every market he's in, including healthcare data. But from a cloud provider perspective, there's a big wrinkle to it as well. So we'll see what happens with Cerner as this acquisition closes, and how soon do they move to Oracle? Because I imagine it's not a quick migration off of AWS, and it's going to cost them a fortune to get off of AWS, I'm sure, because data egress costs are high.
I suspect this is going to backfire, and then Larry Ellison's going to be a very big customer of Amazon, and that's going to burn. because these migrations are always harder than people think, especially at the executive level where they're not, in the details. And so,
So I predict that the acquisition will close. Mm-hmm. There'd be a massive Amazon outage in US East 1, because that's where they always are. That'll impact Cerner, and then Larry will use it to sue the crap out of AWS. Mm. If I were to make a 22 prediction, that'll be it right there.
Well, I still think that workload's going to run on AWS, but I can't disagree with your prediction.
Cerner's pretty big in the rest of the world, though, not just the US.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Epic is really big in the rest of the world, too. I mean, these healthcare companies are massive.
Epic's terrible everywhere.
I mean, it's not a good system. I didn't say it was good, but they are the market leader in the space with 35% of the market versus Cerner's 25% of the market.
So. Larry and Andy, huh? It sounds like it should be a sitcom of some kind. Somebody should make a...
Oh, that would be pretty good.
A sitcom.
That'd be great.
Larry. I don't know.
All right. Well, we are back to weekend update style lightning round this week.
You're welcome, Ryan, audience.
And you're welcome. And Ryan is the first one up. So Ryan, I'll let you start it off.
AWS Trusted Advisor adds 3 optimization checks for Microsoft SQL Server on Amazon EC2. The only Trusted Advisor check I need for Microsoft SQL is don't use Microsoft SQL.
Facts.
Amazon Translate finally announces profanity masking. What were they thinking about? Not the service sooner.
That was well done. I gave you props for all of the gaps that you put into that. Like, that was not editing, folks. No, that was Josh doing it live in real time.
Performance, and I am in awe.
Yeah. AWS Ground Station launches a new antenna location in Punta Arenas in preview, clearly showing that words matter as AWS confuses it all with a new ground station launch for a space thing that isn't actually in space. For a new antenna, which is a physical thing that can't be put into preview because it's either there or it isn't, causing nothing but confusion. So I'm just saying, words matter, Amazon. Words matter.
It's in preview. Can you look at it but not use it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
What does that even mean?
Beautiful.
It's in the console. It just doesn't work.
It's not hooked up to anything. Like, it's just a giant antenna with like a big coax cable that's just dangling off to the side. AWS Transfer Family is now FedRAMP compliant. A true customer for AWS Transfer Family has been identified with the launch of FedRAMP compliance for AWS Transfer. Because yes, the government is so modern that SFTP is the cutting edge.
Yes. Very nice. Well, that is our last lightning round for 2021 as well. And the way the scoreboard looks to me, even if I gave Ryan a point or Jonathan a point for their, very good readings of my show here, I would still win with 17 points to Ryan's 12 and Jonathan's 14. And Peter's lowly too. And I will take my lightning round victory all the way to the bank and reset this to zero starting in January. Yes. So once again, in the back of the equal footing. And I wish you both the best of luck next year at beating me. So now 2 years in a row, I've dominated the lightning round.
I'd hesitate to say that this year you dominated. While you clearly victorious and kudos, we're breathing down your neck. The competition's coming from you.
Yeah. I also feel like Peter gave you guys.
And I will take pity wherever I can get it. It still counts.
Indeed. All right. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, if you made it all the way to the end of the show and you forgot, we will not be back until the second week of January because we're going on vacation. We're all taking the rest of the year off because Log4j has killed us all, as well as 2021 in general. But do stay safe with your families out there during Christmas and New Year's and try not to spread any diseases like Omicron or turn it into a new variant.
Or herpes. Don't spread that either.
Yeah, don't spread that either. So do be safe out there in the world. And we'll see you next year in the cloud. Thanks, guys.
Happy New Year.
Bye, everybody.
And that is the Week in the Cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Foghorn Consulting and Jump Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, and send feedback or ask questions at thecloudpod.net or tweet us with the hashtag #thecloudpod.